This week on Making Contact.
Does Oxy benefit as a result of greater security on the pipeline? You bet.
In Colombia, indigenous people do not want this pipeline protection plan to go through because instead of controlling the violence in the region, in fact, it will exacerbate the violence in the region.
Indigenous people form part of this larger group of Colombian citizens who say we need to have peace.
In Colombia, we are resisting in the midst of a political and a social genocide.
Colombia is the third largest recipient of military aid from Washington. And since 1999, U.S. economic and military involvement there has deepened. On this show, we look at the connection between oil corporations, indigenous peoples, and the civil war in that country. The Colombian government is a key economic and strategic ally of the United States. Colombian officials need to buy U.S.-made arms for their civil war, and the U.S. population's demand for cocaine is largely met by Colombian drug traffickers. The Bush administration has shifted its policy there from a war on drugs to a war on terrorism, now openly sending almost $750 million annually in military aid to the welcoming right-wing Colombian president, Alvaro Uribe. Colombian civilians are caught in the middle as victims of the military, paramilitaries, and guerrilla groups. Monica Enriquez is a Colombian student. In April of 2002, she spoke to an American audience to explain the United States' involvement and its consequences in her country.
Colombia is a country that has been in civil war for 54 years. It's also one of the countries that violates human rights the most, according to Amnesty International. There are 2 million displaced people from their homes, mainly women and children. And since 1999, when the U.S. government and the Colombian government signed Plan Colombia, they have taken from your taxes $2 billion that has been directly invested in military aid. This includes helicopters, weapons, military training, and the pesticides. And the paramilitaries that are, as we know, associated with the military in Colombia, have massacred complete towns of people using horrible tactics of murder and just like trying to horrorize these people, like killing people and peasants in public spaces. There are 2,000 to 4,000 killings every year due to socio-political violence.
They're deceiving the public. They're saying that this is a war against drugs or terrorism or against the guerrillas. When in Colombia, really the violence began long ago. There is a system of violence here.
Hector Madrigan, advisor of the National Peasant Council of Colombia, says that oil and other economic interests compel the United States' involvement in Colombia.
Approximately since 1846, the United States has been intervening in Colombia. At that time, a treaty was signed to bring their troops to Panama. And because of this treaty, the United States was able to separate Panama away from Colombia. The presence of the United States increased significantly after 1924 when Colombia accepted a small amount of money as a payback for the loss of Panama. In 1916, Standard Oil, which is known as Exxon, and then in 1930, Mobile Oil, began to exploit petroleum deposits in Colombia on indigenous land. And as Standard Oil exploited the oil resources, the company killed off the indigenous people. Citibank and Grace also had a very important role in commercializing the coffee industry in Colombia. So the petroleum, the commercialization of coffee, and loans, which is to say the external debt, gave the United States an increasingly large role in Colombian politics. This became even greater after the Second World War, when the United States' investments in Colombia became even larger. And that's when a very open military cooperation began, where the system of violence became very strong. Between 1948 and 1958, in a situation similar to now, 2 million farmers were displaced and 200,000 murdered for the land. In the same time period, Colombia sent troops to Korea, to the U.S. war, to seal this alliance between the system of violence in Colombia and the militarism in the U.S.
Madrigan says the United States has justified its actions via several guises.
Vemos entonces que lo que se trata hoy es de dar nuevos pretextos.
So, we see what's happening now are really new pretexts. They used to speak of war between the liberals and the conservatives. Later, they spoke of war against international communism. More recently, the pretext was the war on drugs, and now it is war on terrorism. There's always a new pretext, but the purpose is the same. They're killing and displacing peasant farmers.
Madrigan adds that the United States military plans are very tightly linked with economic plans for globalization of the economies of Latin America.
El senador Coverdell, por ejemplo, escribía en el Washington Post en abril del 2000.
Senator Coverdell, for example, wrote in the Washington Post in April 2000 that some are afraid that if the United States intervenes in Colombia, it will become another Vietnam. But in any case, it is necessary to intervene. They say this is necessary in order to control Venezuela, because Venezuela is the region's principal producer of petroleum. And then in Ecuador, the indigenous people could take control of the government at any time. And Ecuador also has petroleum. So we see that the petroleum interests are the interests that are really pushing military plans. But this is not limited to this. President Bush's advisors have said that in Brazil, what's needed is the 1964 method. The method in 1964 was a coup d'etat in Brazil. And they want to do this because Brazil has reached agreements with Venezuela for the production and distribution of petroleum.
Powerful corporations, with their influence on United States foreign policy, are in sync with Colombia's rightist government. Despite this, there are broad coalitions in opposition to the current conditions. The resistance brings together women's groups, youth organizations, indigenous peoples, peasants, Afro-Colombians, human rights groups, and unions.
La gente está resistiendo en unas condiciones muy difíciles.
People are resisting under very difficult conditions. Think, for example, last year there were 530 massacres in Colombia. 182 union leaders were assassinated. One of my compañeros belongs to a union of which they've killed 1,700 people in the last 10 years. Also, the political opposition is being systematically exterminated. The Patriotic Union Party, 3,500 members have been killed, including senators, representatives, and mayors. In Colombia, we are resisting in the midst of a political and a social genocide.
In previous years, the United States ostensibly focused its support on Colombian military initiatives to eradicate drug trafficking. Coca crop eradication played a central role in that policy, but by most accounts, failed to stem the tide of cocaine production. President Bush's 2002 proposals broadened the scope of the anti-narcotics campaign, and United States aid will now be used directly for counterinsurgency operations. As Amy Parmelo reports, the drug trade is deeply linked to the Civil War and U.S. military support. Meanwhile, Colombia's indigenous people, though neutral in the war, are suffering greatly from the conflict.
The brutal tactics of drug traffickers and armed groups result in the violent deaths of up to 20 Colombians every day. The guerrilla groups, the FARC and the ELN, as well as the paramilitaries, use coca production to fuel their armed actions. Ligia Inez Asate Arias is the Secretary General of the Confederation of Unions of Colombia for the state of Antioquia. She says one way to decrease the drug trade is to end the war.
If there is to be a negotiated solution to the conflict, there must be a ceasefire. We need the government to demobilize paramilitaries. This would end a lot of the business that these two groups promote, their big business being drugs and weapons. The problem is not in the plants that are being cultivated, nor the poor people or the farmers, but with the powerful people promoting these two businesses. It's not the poor people who are promoting these two industries, but the rich people of the world.
Indigenous groups possess titles to large tracts of rural lands in Colombia, lands with oil reserves, and rivers for hydroelectric production. Transnational corporations take advantage when these resources become more accessible once military incursions and coca fumigation displace the land's inhabitants. Clemencia Herrera is with the National Organization of Indigenous People of Colombia, known by its acronym ONIC. She says that destroying the coca on indigenous lands may destroy indigenous people.
La coca es lo prioritario en la parte tradicional.
The coca is a priority in our traditional culture because it is a medicine. When you talk about a drug war, it's important to note that we're not the ones who started to traffic coca as a drug. Of the 84 different tribes, 52% of us rely on coca for medicinal and sacred use of the plant. They're wiping out the culture totally. The best way to get rid of a crop is by the root, but we're seeing mass fumigation. Not only gets rid of the coca, but how is the chemical itself going to know what plant is what? It gets rid of every single thing in its path, whether it's the coca, food, or trees.
We have to create the kind of economic incentives that will facilitate true development that is consistent with traditions.
Wade Davis is an ethnobotanist and an explorer in residence with the National Geographic Society.
Well, in the early 1970s, I was part of a botanical expedition to seek a deeper understanding of coca, a plant that was known to the Incas as a divine leaf of immortality, the most sacred plant in the Andes. And it was a rather remarkable assignment that came through the Harvard Botanical Museum from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, because here was a plant that had been used for over 4,000 years by the pre-Columbian peoples of South America, and yet even though at that time efforts to eradicate the fields were already underway, astonishing little was known about the plant.
Davis studied the pharmacology of the plant, as well as the cultural role of coca.
We know that in the time of the Inca, in particular, it was revered beyond all other plants. And this reverence for the plant has persisted to this day, and indeed today there is no moment in the life of Andean peoples that is not in some sense affected by coca. No elder can be led into the realm of the dead, no field can be planted, no child brought into the realm of the living without some kind of use of this most remarkable plant. Distances are measured not in miles or in kilometers, but in coca chews. When you meet someone on the trail, you don't shake hands, you trade leaves. When you plant a field, leaves are scattered into the wind or onto the soil of Pachamama. Now, because cocaine became such a problem in this country, coca became, in some sense, associated with it. But it's useful to remember that to compare coca with cocaine is like comparing the luscious fruit of a peach with the prussic acid that you'll find within the pit of that peach. We, of course, in our ethnobotanical studies, were readily able to document the wondrous use of this plant in folk culture today in Peru, Bolivia, and much of Colombia, highlands and lowlands. But at the same time, perhaps the most important thing that we did was the first nutritional study of the plant. And what we found horrified our backers at the U.S. government, because we showed with one elegant scientific assay that coca, yes, had a small amount of cocaine hydrochloride in it, roughly analogous to the concentration of caffeine that you'll find in a coffee bean. And clearly, if you extracted caffeine from tea or coffee and injected or snorted it, you might have a drug abuse problem. But no one seems to be concerned about the fact that every DEA drug abuse conference sets up in the morning with a big dose of coffee.
Davis says that in addition to its small amount of cocaine hydrochloride absorbed through the mouth, the coca leaf is also
chock full of vitamins. It also had more calcium in it than any plant that had ever been studied by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which made it perfect for a traditional diet that lacked a dairy product. It also was suggested in the early days that it had enzymes in it which enhanced the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation. My colleague Tim Plowman put into stark profile the draconian efforts that are underway to this day to eradicate the traditional fields. And he showed without doubt that this was a plant that had been used with no evidence of toxicity, let alone addiction, for over 4,000 years by the pre-Columbian peoples of South America, and indeed by the people today in South America.
Clemencia Herrera says she wants to preserve the traditional indigenous use of coca, but that requires ending the disruptions from the Colombian Civil War.
La guerrilla y los paramilitares.
The guerrillas and the paramilitaries live in the city and live in the jungle also. And specifically, we indigenous people become caught up because we live in the most remote territories of the country. These armed people take refuge in our territories. And when the confrontations come, obviously we're trapped.
Está la guerra, pero tenemos que buscar la paz.
Right now, Colombia is in a war, but we've reached the point where we've come together as the different social organizations that make up the society. We've agreed that we have to have peace. Indigenous people form part of this larger group of Colombian citizens who say we need to have peace.
For Making Contact, I'm Amy Pomerleau.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcript orders. That's 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcript orders. That's 800-529-5736. According to a U.S. State Department report on human rights, indigenous communities suffer disproportionately from the internal armed conflict in Colombia. Their struggle for territorial and cultural rights and their vision of community development pit indigenous people against powerful economic interests fueling the war. Kevin Koenig is an oil campaigner with Amazon Watch.
In Colombia, indigenous people find themselves on the front lines of the country's expanding oil frontier. In Colombia, which is very similar to places like Ecuador or Nigeria, we see this pattern of collusion and active collaboration between repressive regimes and militaries, basically acting as private security for oil corporations. In Colombia, oil brings violence.
You say oil brings violence. That seems like a bit of a slogan-y one-to-one correlation. Could you really explain why you say that?
Basically, for a lot of communities, oil extraction has brought the war to their doorstep. In Colombia, the two leftist guerrilla groups, the FARC and the ELN, you also have the paramilitaries, all of which are attracted to oil operations. Oil infrastructure essentially becomes a magnet for all the armed actors in Colombia, and that war gets played out in the villages and communities of innocent people of Colombia.
Koenig says that Occidental Petroleum, known as Oxy, is a large Los Angeles-based oil company and has a history of fueling the war directly.
We know that in the early 1980s, Occidental Petroleum, when it was first looking to extract oil from Colombia, they went into the Arauca and northeast areas of Colombia, and there was already a guerrilla presence. And in order to operate, they paid off the ELN to the tune of about $3 million the first year. This seed money was critical for the groups to grow and become what they have today, which, you know, tragically and perversely are the same groups that now bomb this Oxy's pipeline.
We asked Larry Mirage, Occidental spokesperson, if that was true.
Now, some sources have said that Occidental once paid the guerrillas that are now apparently bombing your pipeline. Can you sort of speak to that irony?
Well, people have made some speculations to that effect that don't really have any basis in fact.
But one of those people is Occidental's own late founder, Armand Hammer, who boasted to the Wall Street Journal in 1985 that his company paid off the guerrillas and did whatever was needed to operate in Colombia. Today, as guerrillas bomb the pipeline, Oxy is more closely linked with the Colombian military. Again, Larry Mirage.
Occidental the operation in general could not function out there without military support. We do not have a private security force that we depend on to provide protection for the assets and for personnel. So we, as a matter of policy, really depend on the legitimate authorities to provide a measure of protection for the operation. In this case, it's the Army, it's the police.
Mirage also stressed that Occidental doesn't fund the military directly. Instead, it pays its Colombian pipeline partner, Ecopetrol, which then contracts with the military. However, according to an extensive LA Times article on March 17, 2002, Oxy has direct ties to the Colombian military, particularly the notorious 18th Brigade. The article details how the brigade, Oxy, and the U.S. military were involved in a massacre in the village of Santo Domingo in 1998. The LA Times reports that Colombian Air Force and Army commanders gathered to plan the attack in a conference room at the Occidental Petroleum Complex. Airscan, a private company with links to Occidental, conducts surveillance to protect the pipeline and provided the Colombian military with target information for the massacre. Amazon Watch's Kevin Koenig.
The big question to deal with is the collusion. You know, the big question of why is a private security firm for a U.S. oil company in Colombia flying together with the Colombian military using their infrared scanners to pinpoint civilian targets on the ground?
More recently, military involvement around the pipeline has become a controversy in the U.S. Congress, since the Bush administration is proposing $98 million in additional aid to Colombia specifically to protect Occidental's Cañón Limón pipeline. Koenig says the pipeline is being attacked by all parties in the war.
On the left side, you have the two guerrilla groups, the FARC and the ELN. That's their way of basically protesting the intervention of a U.S. oil company in a resource that they feel should be just for Colombia. The other reason that the guerrillas are after the pipeline is that there is in place a $1 a barrel war tax that oil companies pay to the Colombian military, which allows the Colombian military to carry out its offensive against the guerrillas. And you have the paramilitary operations who are siphoning off to the tune of $5 million a month, illegally tapping the pipeline. And it's that money that's helping them, helping fuel the majority of the massacres and atrocities that we're seeing happening in Colombia.